The point is, family connections haven't been the secret to my success. Seriously, though, after I moved to Los Angeles, I started to gain some pretty influential friends within the entertainment industry. Paris Hilton and I became incredibly close. Later, I went on to date Ray J. Remember him? And it really shot me into celebrity status. I used the attention from that relationship to get my own show on E! And then made millions with many kind of products. When Kanye asked me to be his wife, well, wait, shoot, nope. That's Kim Kardashian. The secret to my success isn't celebrity status. All joking aside, my success has a lot to do with waking up early, being the hardest working person in the room, asking for help, being able to fail over and over again, and working constantly to improve both myself and my brand. But plenty of people do those things and don't experience the kind of success I have. You want to know why that is? Why I believe I'm the one writing this book right now when people who've tried to do exactly the same thing I haven't succeeded? It's simple, actually. It's not about talent, skill, money, or connections. It's because when they went after their dreams and came up against a roadblock, when they experienced rejection or when someone or something told them no, they listened. I am successful because I refuse to take no for an answer. I am successful because I have never once believed my dreams were someone else's to manage. That's the incredible part about your dreams. Nobody gets to tell you how big they can be. When it comes to your dreams, no is not an answer. The word no is not a reason to stop. Instead, think of it as a detour or a yield sign. No means merge with caution. No reminds you to slow down, to reevaluate where you are, and to judge how the new position you're in can better prepare you for your destination. In other words, if you can't get through the front door, try the side window. If the window is locked, maybe you slide down the chimney. No doesn't mean that you stop. It simply means that you change course in order to make it to your destination. I realize, though, that not everybody looks at no the way I do. In order to inspire you to run headlong after your dreams, I may have to shift your perception of no. I'm going to have to give you everything I can think of to get you there. And I'm going to start with this question. What if life isn't happening to you? What if the hard stuff, the amazing stuff, the love, the joy, the hope, the fear, the weird stuff, the funny stuff, the stuff that takes you so low you're lying on the floor crying and thinking, how did I get here? What if none of it is happening to you? What if all of it is happening for you? It's all about perception, you guys. Perception means that we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Take a burning house. To a fireman, a burning house is a job to do. Maybe even it's his life's work or mission. For an arsonist, a burning house is something exciting and good. What if it's your house? What if it's your family who's standing outside watching every earthly possession you own burning up? That burning house becomes something else entirely. You don't see things as they are. You see things through the lens of what you think and feel and believe. Perception is reality, and I'm here to tell you that your reality is colored much more by your past experiences than by what is actually happening to you. If your past tells you that nothing ever works out, that life is against you, and that you'll never succeed, then how likely are you to keep fighting for something you want? Or, on the flip side, if you quit accepting no as the end of the conversation whenever you run up against opposition, you can shift your perception and fundamentally reshape your life. Every single part of your life, your gratitude, the way you manage stress, how kind you are to others, how happy you are, can be changed by a shift in your perception. I don't have an entire book to devote to this topic, so today I'm just going to focus on your dreams. Let's talk about the goals you have for your life and how you can help yourself to achieve them. In order to do that, you have to name your goals. You have to shout out your hopes and dreams like the great Bambino calling his shot. You need the courage to stand up and say, "This one, right here, this is mine." Before you continue reading, take a few moments to focus on a specific dream. Get out a piece of paper and write it down. Maybe write down 10 dreams. Maybe start with little innocuous things and keep writing until the truth comes out. Come on, girl, no one is watching. There's nobody here to judge. Cue elevator music. All right, do you have your dream? Great. Maybe for some of you, that's the first time you've admitted that dream to yourself. But I'm willing to bet that most of you have met that dream before, even if you've never had the courage to put it down on paper. Hello, old friend. Perhaps it's been around since childhood. Maybe it's something you're currently working on. Maybe you used to work on it, but you gave up. Either way, if this is still a dream you have, then chances are you've experienced some rejection where this dream is concerned. So my first mission is to change the way you see the word no, to take away your fear of it. Fear is driving your choices and affecting your decisions. So let's take the fear away. The best way I know how to do that is to talk about it. The Bible says, "Let that which is in the darkness be brought into the light." When things are allowed to sit in the darkness, when we're afraid to speak them aloud, we give them power. The darkness lets those fears fester and grow until they become stronger over time. If you never allow your fears out, then how in the world can you disseminate them? Why do you think every chapter of this book begins with a lie I used to believe? Because I want to encourage you to speak your own lies into the world. The trouble is, we rarely know they are lies until someone points them out or we get past them. Before we can name them, they just disguise themselves as things we're afraid of. Think about it. So let's take the fear away. Let's go through some of the reasons why people give up on their dreams. I want you to ask yourself if any of these examples sound like you. Some people quit because a voice of authority tells them to. Voice of authority can mean all sorts of things. Maybe your first boss said you weren't right for your dream job, and you believed it. Maybe a parent, out of love or fear or caution or their own issues, told you not to try. Maybe a spouse or a partner or best friend was afraid of what would happen to your relationship if you grew, and so they decided to keep you anchored to the ground. Maybe that voice of authority said you're not right for it. Someone said you're too fat to train for a marathon, or that you're too young to build your own business. They said you're too old to take dance lessons. They said you're too female to travel by yourself. Maybe the voice of authority is your own. Maybe the negative self-talk in your head has been playing on repeat for your entire life. Maybe an entire industry of experts is saying you're not right. I have wanted to be an author for as long as I've understood that books were created by actual people. Like most wannabe authors, I started approximately 73 manuscripts, but never actually finished a single one. Then, several years ago, I decided to stop giving up. Just once, I thought. Just once, I'd like to know what it's like to finish. So I began working on my historical fiction meets time travel book. Because, I mean, why not write that on weekends? Out of the blue, I was approached by a literary agent. Okay, just to give context, I suppose it wasn't out of the blue. I was a popular blogger and had built up a following of fans as well as a lot of publicity as a celebrity party planner by this time. The lit agent asked me if I'd ever considered writing a book. Of course I started regaling her with tales of my time-traveling historical romance, which, in case you're wondering, is basically every literary agent's worst nightmare as a pitch from an unknown, unproven author. So this woman, bless her, read the first 20 pages of that dumpster fire and politely came back a week later to inform me that it wasn't really her style. She'd actually been reaching out to see if I wanted to do a nonfiction book on party planning. Since I was expressing an interest in fiction, though, she wondered if I'd be interested in writing a Romana Clay. I never even heard of that term, but a quick Google search informed me that it's fiction about actual notable people. You just change the names to keep yourself from getting sued. A great example is The Devil Wears Prada. The agent's question was whether or not I had any juicy stories after having survived years of celebrity events. Boy, did I ever. As soon as we got off the phone, I knew the story immediately. I knew the story because it was my story. I'd moved from a small southern-minded town to Los Angeles as a teenager. Before I was old enough to drink legally, I was working parties for the biggest A-list celebrities on the planet. I was a fish out of water and always awkward, but somehow built a career within that space. I didn't have to dream up material. I had years of stories so juicy I couldn't have made them up if I tried. I wrote 10 pages and emailed them to her right away. 2 days later, she wrote back, "I can sell this all day long." A literary agent. A real-life, legit literary agent told me that she could sell my book if I was willing to finish it. I nearly choked on my joy. I became obsessed. I barely saw my husband or my kids as I wrote like an insane person until my first draft was finished. I kept telling myself that the only reason I didn't have a book deal already was because I'd never actually finished a manuscript. So I believed this book was fated. I imagined in intricate detail what it would be like to hold the published copy in my hands. I did finish the book, and the literary agent sent it to every publisher in New York. The initial responses were so kind and encouraging. Editors would write long emails back explaining why it wasn't for them, but telling me how much they'd enjoyed it. My belief that we were going to sell it only increased when 3 other publishers asked for conference calls to discuss it. When I dialed into that first call, I thought I was going to pee my pants. When we got on the phone, the publishing team started by telling me how much they liked me, my online presence, my writing style, etc. They praised the book as funny and cute. Good things, as far as I knew. "Our concern," said the editor, "is that it's too sweet." I had no idea what that meant, but since it was my first book, I assured them that anything like that could be fixed in an edit. "We were hoping you'd be open to changes." "Of course," I assured them. "I'd be open to ritual sacrifice if it meant selling my first book." "So you'd feel comfortable adding some steam." Y'all, I had no idea what she was talking about. My brain conjured up the image of a manhole cover with steam coming out. "What exactly did you have in mind?" I hedged. "Sex. It needs sex, Rachel. No young woman in her early 20s who lives in L.A. is a virgin. Nobody will believe this love story. If you spice it up, this could be a bestseller." I'm trying to remember if I've ever been so uncomfortable in a professional setting in my life. For context, it's important to note that this was right when 50 Shades of Grey was breaking into the book world. Since publishing chases trends like any other industry, every editor was hyper-focused on trying to tap into that fan base. I had zero idea how to respond to them. Y'all, I'm no saint. I've read books with sex in them before. Don't tell my meemaw. But I had no earthly clue that someone would ever ask me to write it. Also, I loved that the heroine in my book was naive and innocent, and I thought that's what made her special. The more they tried to convince me to write steam into my book, the more I wondered if I was in an after-school special. Like, "Hey, Rachel, just smoke this crack and we'll be friends with you." I politely declined. "We totally understand," they told me. "But without that element, this book is too sweet for the market. Nobody will buy it as is." I was devastated. 2 more calls with publishers went exactly the same way. Then, one after another, every publisher left on our submission list turned it down. It was a Friday afternoon when the very last publisher passed. I remember locking myself in the bathroom and sobbing, and you guys, these were not gentle, beautiful tears. This was like, my dreams are over, everyone hates my book, I am a terrible writer, ugly tears. I can't tell you how long I stayed down on the bathroom tile, but I can tell you that I eventually got back up. I dried my tears and walked to the kitchen to pour a glass of wine. Then I sat down at my crappy laptop where I'd written my terrible, prudish manuscript that nobody wanted and Googled, how do you self-publish a book? In February of 2014, I self-published Party Girl, about a naive, sweet, and yes, virginal party planner in her early 20s living in L.A. That first weekend, I think it sold 50 copies, and likely 45 of those were bought by Dave. Every week, though, I'd sell a few here and a handful there. The sales kept growing, and people were passing it around to their friends. As it turns out, the sweetness of the main character was the exact thing that people liked about the book. 6 months later, a publisher called and asked if they could buy it from me and offer me a deal for two more books to turn it into a series. To date, that single book, the one I was told no one would buy, has sold over 100,000 copies. It also launched my career as an author. Here's the most important piece of that whole story. Are you paying attention? If I had listened to the experts, that book would still be sitting on my computer today. Nobody. Not a voice of authority, not your mama, not the foremost expert in your arena, gets to tell you how big your dreams can be. They can talk all they want, but you get to decide if you're willing to listen. Another reason people give up on their dreams? It's difficult and, or it's taking too long. Goals and dreams are hard. I get it. Actually accomplishing them is so much harder than you think it will be. Maybe you're making progress, but it's only an inch at a time. Meanwhile, your friend Tammy has been promoted twice, your sister is married with two kids, and you feel as though you're still way back there at the start when everyone is passing you by. Some days you feel so discouraged you want to cry. Go ahead and cry. Rend your garments and wail to the heavens like some biblical mourner. Get it all out. Then dry your eyes and wash your face and keep on going. You think this is hard? That's because it is. So what? Nobody said it would be easy. You're tired? How many times in your life have you been tired but you found a way to keep going? How many of you reading this right now have given up on a dream because it was exhausting to keep chasing it? In the same vein, how many of you have ever gone through labor? Even if you haven't before, I know you can understand the gist. No matter how you bring a baby into the world, even through adoption, it's emotionally and physically exhausting, but somehow you find a way through. You dig down deep for strength you didn't know you had because the process is literally life or death. Don't tell me you don't have it in you to want something more for your life. Don't tell me you have to give up because it's difficult. This is life or death too. This is the difference between living a life you always dreamed of or sitting alongside the death of the person you were meant to become. That's what it feels like to me when I've given up on a dream, even for a little while, as if I'm at a wake, as if I'm sitting in a room and looking at the evidence of what could have been. I'm sure many of you know what that's like, and you either want to change it or keep yourself from getting there in the first place. You have to do something about it. You have to reach down inside yourself and remember the reason you started this. You better find the will to keep going, because if you don't, I promise you someone else will. If that happens, girl, you will watch someone else achieve your dreams and enjoy the spoils of their hard-fought battle. And if that happens, you will understand one of the greatest lessons in this life, that the only thing worse than giving up is wishing that you hadn't. You think your dream is taking too long? It took Julia Child 10 years to write Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Her work changed cooking for people all over the world and launched her career. James Cameron worked on Avatar for 15 years, and it is the most successful film in the history of time. On January 3, 1870, ground was broken for the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge. That project took 10 years, and during that time, the lives of so many men on the building crew were lost. But you guys, the Brooklyn Bridge still stands as a symbol of New York, and 135 years later, it brings 43 million cars to and from Manhattan every single year. Don't you get it? Nothing that lasts is accomplished quickly. Nobody's entire legacy is based on a single moment, but rather the collection of one's experiences. If you're lucky, your legacy will be a lifetime in the making. Between my event company and the media business I run now, it's taken me 13 years of work to get to this place, and not one of those years was wasted. I needed 13 years to gain the knowledge to write to you about this topic. I needed 13 years of speaking to college students, MOPS groups, and panel discussions to build my skill enough to give the keynote speech that served as the inspiration for this chapter. I needed to fail at public speaking and make mistakes over and over again to learn how to do that. I needed to write crappy manuscripts that I never finished and then one that nobody wanted to buy. I needed to fight my way into the publishing industry and spend years making my presence known before I was in a place where someone would give me the opportunity for a book like this. I needed to endure personal hardships and discouragement and one rejection on top of another, all so that I could stand right here and say to you, your dream is worth fighting for. And while you're not in control of what life throws at you, you are in control of the fight. The last reason people give up on their dreams? Something traumatic gets in your way. Disaster is the ultimate excuse. Divorce or illness or something far worse happens to you, and sometimes the goals slip quietly into the background and get left there. We leave them because this trauma is so heavy, we just can't carry one more thing. Sometimes trauma happens, and if we're being honest, a part of us rejoices, thinking, well, now nobody can expect anything else from me because it's a miracle enough that I'm upright. Let me take a moment to tell those of you who are dealing with and fighting through something painful, it is a miracle that you're sitting here. You are nobly doing your best to battle your way through it. You are a warrior because of the trials you are going through. But don't you dare squander the strength you have earned just because the acquisition of it was painful. Those are the most important stories to share. You can use that strength to pave a path for others to follow along behind. I've shared many of my own painful stories in the chapters of this book, and none of them have been easy to talk about. But I do it because I hope that by sharing them, I'm able to help some of you who've walked through similar things. I've also talked about my own goals and dreams and the way I've pushed myself to achieve them. Every single one of those dreams has served a purpose in my life. Sometimes it was a small change, and sometimes it was life-changing. But in every circumstance, I grew for having walked through it. Friends, it's not about the goal or the dream you have. It's about who you become on your way to that goal. When a voice of authority says it's taking too long, you're too fat, old, tired, or female for it, or your trauma is too big, do you know what they are giving you? Permission to quit. You're already scared. You're already second-guessing yourself, and when someone or something comes along and speaks into that exact thing you were already questioning, you think, yep, that's what I thought. I give up. Look again at those dreams you wrote down on your paper at the start of this chapter. Now listen to me. You do not have permission to quit. I revoke that permission. I take away the power those people or circumstances put over your life, and I give it back to you. You think it's not that easy? Of course it is. This is all about perception, right? Your perception of what's holding you back is currently big and bad and terrifying, but those obstacles are only real if you believe them. It's all in your hands now. Everything that happens from here on out is entirely up to you. This is the hard part because I will tell you right now, nobody will ever care about your dream as much as you do. Ever. Do you hear me, sister? Whether you want to lose weight or write a book or be on TV or travel the world on a speaking tour, you are the steward of your own dreams. Maybe you want to own your own home, get your degree, or save your marriage. Maybe it's a shop on Etsy, opening a small business, or getting the lead in the local production of Oklahoma this fall. Whatever it is, big or small, grandiose or simple, nobody can care about it the way you do. Even if you have a supportive family, even if you have the greatest friends alive, even if your spouse is the most uplifting, encouraging human and your number one fan, even then, girl, they do not want it as much as you do. It doesn't keep them up at night. It doesn't light their soul on fire. It's your dream. Your own special wish that your heart made long before you were even conscious of it. You want to see it come to fruition? Well, then, you have to understand that nobody can take it away from you, and ultimately, nobody is going to help you achieve it. Not really. You have to decide to pursue your wildest dreams, no matter what they are, no matter how simple or extravagant, no matter if they seem ridiculous to others or maybe even too easy. It doesn't matter. They're your dreams, and you are allowed to chase them. Not because you are more special or talented or well-connected, but because you are worthy of wanting something more. Because you are worthy of not letting your past dictate your future. Start today. Start right now, this very second, and promise yourself, heck, promise me, that you'll reach for the big stuff. Do you want the big stuff for your life? You won't get there by saying yes. Yes is the easy part. You'll get there by not giving up when you hear the word no. Things that helped me. Number one, audacity. It's pretty audacious to ignore what other people, even experts, are telling you is right. I think we could all use a little more audacity around these parts. I don't mean that you need to become militant or disrespectful. I just mean you should keep your eyes on your goal regardless of what gets in your way. Number two, alternate paths. I worry when I give this advice that some random person who listens to the idea of not giving up on her dreams will hear, "Go harass people until they give you what you want." That's not going to get anybody anywhere, and we all know it. Use the no you hear as an indication that you should try an alternative route. Number three, keeping my goals in plain sight. It's easy to focus on your goals when you're fired up or excited about a new project. But focusing becomes harder when life interferes with your direct access to keep working on it. So pin up your dream somewhere you can see it. I'm a big fan of displaying visuals inside my closet door to remind me every single day of what my aim is. Currently taped to my door, the cover of Forbes featuring self-made female CEOs, a vacation house in Hawaii, and a picture of Beyonce. Obvi. Chapter 7. The Lie. I'm bad at sex. I used to be really bad at sex. Whoa, Nelly. You didn't think I was going there, but I totally am. I'm going to talk about sex as a married Christian woman, and I hope it'll be okay. My husband? He's likely hiding under a rock right now because me writing about this is definitely his worst nightmare. My worst nightmare is getting chased by Bigfoot, so I guess we all have our crosses to bear, Dave. But Dave shouldn't be worried. I'm not writing about him. I'm writing about me, and my bad sex. I'm choosing to write about this big, scary, embarrassing thing at the risk of petrifying my in-laws and giving Meemaw a heart attack because I think it's important. I don't think women talk about it enough. Oh, sure, the world talks about it as much as it can, as loud as it can, as often as it can, but not in a realistic way. Not in a way that makes tangible sense to a virginal clarinet player whose experience with men when she met her husband was equal to her experience with hunting large game in the African wilds. Which is to say, none. None at all. My early opportunities for sexual education included ladies at church, who didn't speak about it within my hearing, or media as a whole, which showed me an ideal that was impossible to achieve. So I walked into my marriage with no realistic idea of what to expect. Which is flipping ridiculous. I wish just one time before I got married, someone had said, look, here are my experiences, here's what you need to know, here's what you should consider, and also, the first few times you have sex, you should pee afterwards so you don't get a UTI. Somewhere in Texas, an older reader just fainted. Yes, I wrote about a urinary tract infection. If that freaks you out, move right along to the next chapter, sister, because it's going to get way more intimate than that. I knew very little about sex other than what I had gleaned from TV or movies, so I was terrible at it. And not terrible as in awkward, though I was most definitely that. It was terrible because I was miserable. And I made my husband miserable, too. 5 years into our marriage, our sex life was nearly non-existent. By comparison, we'll celebrate our 14th wedding anniversary this year, and now our sex life is the stuff of legends. No, seriously. We do it more than any married couple you know. Or at least, more often than most married couples with 4 kids and 2 full-time jobs. We have sex not out of obligation, but because it's really, really good. When it's really good, why would you not go at it like a couple of howler monkeys whenever you can? Today, it's awesome. But it was a long road from there to here. And I'm going to tell you all about it in case you find yourself in the same place. And because I don't want you to get a UTI. Listen up. When I met Dave, I was 19 years old, and he was 27. I had never been on a date before, and he didn't know how much younger I was than him. As I've already told you, when the truth came out a couple months in, it went over like an obese cat falling off the back fence. It was an ungraceful and violent fall, but we still landed on our feet. Dave has been my best friend since that first year together. He is my favorite human on the planet, and I love him so much it makes my heart want to explode. When we got married, we had the happiest life I could have possibly dreamed up for myself. And as for sex, we did it like rabbits. We did it like rabbits because that's what you're supposed to do as newlyweds, right? How many times could we do it in a day? How many times in an hour? I would do it in the rain, in the dark, on a train, in a car, in a tree. You get the point, Sam I am. We were having a lot of sex. And I loved it. I loved it because being physically close with him made me feel cherished and adored. I loved it because it made him so happy. It made us so happy. We were newlyweds. We were having sex, and life was good. But as the first couple of years went on and the newness wore off, the joy of the honeymoon phase wore off too. In the beginning, my excitement made me bold. As time went on, though, I felt less comfortable, as if a switch had been flipped. I was raised to be this good Christian girl. Now I was supposed to be a sex kitten, but I had no idea how. So I drank. We'd go on a date and I'd have just enough wine to feel sexy. Then I'd try and do sexy things or act in a sexy way, but I rarely enjoyed it as much as he did. Did I pretend to enjoy it? Heck yes. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Then I started to resent the fact that I wasn't enjoying it. Resented that I thought I should have sex even when I wasn't excited about it. Then I had a baby. And my body morphed, and my stomach stretched out, and my boobs leaked, and I was exhausted. Sex was basically the least enjoyable thing I could imagine. But I kept doing it. Kept pretending that I loved every second. I never once talked to Dave about how I was feeling. I was too embarrassed and unsure. I was also nervous about hurting his feelings, so I kept it to myself. More time passed, and our sex life was hanging on by a thread. By the time our second son was a toddler, sex barely happened at all. And when I came out of the fog of being a mother of two and thought enough to ask Dave about it, the answer was hard to hear. "Why don't we have sex anymore?" I asked him one night. He looked at me as though the question hurt his feelings. I got tired of being shot down. I was immediately defensive. "I don't shoot you down. I always say yes." "You might agree, Rachel, but you don't actually want to. And that's worse than not having it at all." Initially, I was pretty annoyed. Here I was taking one for the team, and he was hurt because I wasn't more enthusiastic. But the more I thought about it, the more I understood how right he was. I might have been agreeing to sex, but I was stiff and uncomfortable, tired and unenthusiastic. Agreeing to it did not mean I was embracing it. My husband could tell I wasn't enjoying it, so rather than asking me to participate halfway, he had just stopped asking altogether. What a bummer. They say the first step to fixing something is admitting you have a problem. Now, I know many of you are super in touch with your own feminine mystique. You've got the whole sex thing down pat, and you have 100 orgasms a week. Good for you, sister. Seriously, you're my hero. And the following advice probably isn't for you. For you, what I have to say will sound trite and basic or maybe even naive. That's cool, because these are the things that worked for me, and I share them in case they are helpful to someone who is like me or who I used to be. Here are the steps I took to go from being bad at sex to being exceptional at sex. There are 7 of them, one for every day of the week. Things that helped me. Number 1. I redefined sex in my own mind. For the longest time, sex symbolized a lot of things, and not all of them were positive. I decided to change what I thought sex was. This might not be what sex is for you, your friends, or the Holy Ghost and all the saints, but going forward, I decided that sex was supposed to be a fun experience that would always be more compelling than whatever else I could be doing. Up until that point, I was continuously weighing sex against other things, reading a book, watching TV, etc., and it was playing second fiddle. But if I reminded myself that sex was always an awesome opportunity, then I would presumably want to choose it. Number 2. I figured out how sex could be an earth-shattering experience. When you're uncomfortable or don't feel sexy or are nervous or shy or whatever, you're not going to enjoy yourself. If you're not enjoying yourself, you're not having good sex. So I asked myself, how can I enjoy this more? What's holding me back? The answer? Me. Next, I spoke with Dave about all the things I was thinking and feeling. It shocked me that after all our years together, I could still be so embarrassed, but I pushed through it. We needed to be on the same page, and the only way to get there was by opening up the book and talking to him about it. Number 3. I read Hebrews 13:4. Part of my hang-ups were related to my being a good Christian girl who couldn't reconcile becoming a freak in the sheets. And then I read Hebrews 13:4. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled. Now, straight up, I'm sure I'm not reading this right. I'm sure someone who studied theology will tell me that this actually means something different. But what I read, or what I take away when I read that line, is that the things that happen in my bed with my husband cannot be weird or bad or wrong. Let me back up and say there are definitely things that a committed, monogamous couple can do sexually that can be incredibly hurtful to them both. Pornography, for example, is extremely damaging to both the consumer and the people being used as objects for your lust. But the other stuff? Lingerie, leather, toys, role play, trying every position possible, going at it on the kitchen table, dirty talk, whatever. If it turns you on and doesn't hurt you, I say go for it. Number 4. I embrace my body. Having a low opinion of your body is so damaging to your ability to enjoy sex. I used to worry about whether or not my tummy was tight or if my butt looked okay in those panties. You know what Dave was thinking when I took off my clothes? Boobies! Your partner is just thrilled you showed up, and all those things you're questioning aren't helping anyone. I practiced positive self-talk about how great my butt looked or how sexy I was. I did it so much that at some point, I started to believe it. Number 5. I committed to my orgasm. Okay, just writing that line makes me blush. I'm imagining some future book signing where a reader comes up to my table and says, "So, you committed to your orgasm." But this is important, and even if it embarrasses me, I want you to know it. Back in the day when we first started having sex, an orgasm for me was like icing on the cake. But here's the thing, ladies. Orgasms are not icing on the cake. Orgasms are the cake. A second orgasm is icing on the cake. Remember how I said that I had to figure out how to make sex the greatest thing ever? Remember how I told you that I wanted to desire it over anything else in my life? You know how you do that? With orgasms. I decided years ago that I would never, and I mean never, again have sex that didn't include an orgasm for me. When I told Dave this plan, he agreed it was the greatest idea I'd ever come up with. Because here's the thing, for most of us, our partners are thrilled to give us pleasure. And if we're both committed to my orgasm at the outset, it will happen. Number 6. I had to figure out what turns me on. Oh sure, I'd been turned on many times in my life, but I'd never truly considered the difference between what really did it for me and what was just situational. Knowing what turns me on was key, because remember, my orgasms were our new endgame, and I don't know how to have one without being turned on. So, we experimented until I learned myself and my body better. Feel free to head back up to the undefiled marriage bed paragraph for a list of ideas. Number 7. We committed to having sex every day for a month. Years ago, at the outset of changing up our sex lives, Dave and I initiated something we called Sexy September. We vowed to have sex every day during the month of September. No excuses. It was pretty daunting in the beginning, especially with full-time jobs and 2 little kids, but the end result was fantastic. It gave me the opportunity to experiment and to try things out without any pressure. Also, shockingly, having more sex made us want to have more sex. I highly encourage you to pick your own sexy month and go for it. Chapter 8. The Lie. I don't know how to be a mom. I am the worst pregnant woman you've ever met in your life. No, really. I hate basically every part of pregnancy except the baby you get at the end. I have friends who love it. Like, capital L-O-V-E, wish they could carry 100 babies and be pregnant forever. I fully support their Earth Mother calling and the obvious joy they find in being a vessel for human life. But I don't share it. I am thankful for my pregnancies. So stinking thankful to the bottom of my heart that God blessed me with the ability to carry 3 beautiful little boys to term. I do not take this for granted when I know so many women who pray for the same blessing have not received it. But every single part of pregnancy is hard on me. The morning sickness never once went away with the morning, nor did it end after the first trimester. I put on pregnancy weight like it was my part-time job, then felt incapable of taking it off. My back hurt, my feet hurt, and during my first pregnancy, I got a varicose vein in the most terrible place a human being can get a varicose vein, which meant I had to wear special weight-bearing underwear with each consecutive pregnancy. Side note, if you were ever curious about the easiest way to crush a gal's spirit, I'd recommend searching groin support panties on the internet. But I digress. The point is, I'm pretty bad at pregnancy. On top of everything else I've mentioned, I also dealt with unrelenting fear. What if I ate bologna and contracted listeria? What if my blueberry-sized fetus developed some rare disease since the last time I'd had an ultrasound? What if all the Carl's Jr. chicken strips I was eating gave him high cholesterol? What if the cord wrapped around his neck? What if the room wasn't ventilated enough when I painted the nursery? What if the placenta previa hadn't cleared up? What if that vodka Red Bull I drank when I was 2 weeks pregnant but didn't yet know it had hurt him? Seriously, though, what if the cord wrapped around his neck? The worries were overbearing, and I managed them with the dignity of a geriatric terrier, which is to say, I barked at anyone who got too close, and I needed a special step stool to hoist myself in and out of bed. When the blessed event finally occurred, I was ecstatic. Firstly, because I was finally going to meet Jackson Cage, a child we had dreamed up and named on a cross-country road trip years before. Also, I was finally going to have my body back to myself. I was euphoric to have made it through the labor, something I honestly believed would be the toughest part of motherhood. But at home, with Jackson in all his perfect glory, I was unprepared for how inadequate I'd feel as a new mom. I loved him obsessively. I was also terrified of him. All the fears I had while he was inside of me suddenly multiplied by 100 million. I barely slept at night because I was positive he'd stop breathing if I wasn't there to watch him do it. Breastfeeding was hard and painful, and I never produced enough milk to feed the giant offspring Dave and I created. We had to supplement with formula. We had to learn how to manage his reflux. We had to navigate a middle-of-the-night ER visit when he got a high fever at 7 weeks old, all while dealing with the soul-sucking loss of sleep. My husband has always been my best friend and my favorite human on earth, but I remember once, when Jackson was about a month and a half old, looking at Dave and sincerely believing I hated him. Like, to the pit of my soul, hated him. I like to tell young married couples about the time I hated Dave. I like to tell them because I want them to know how this feeling is totally normal, and they'll likely find themselves there now and again. Jackson was 6 weeks old, which, by the way, friends, is the most probable week for real, unadulterated hatred, and he was still waking up in the night. It's important to emphasize the word still here because I think my young, ignorant, pre-child self thought we'd be back to neutral and coasting toward parental bliss by the end of month one. Bless my precious childlike heart. Becoming new parents is such a fake-out. The first 2 weeks, you're deep in euphoria, and yes, it's hard, but people are bringing you casseroles, and your mama is still in town to help, and you have this perfect little cherub whom you love so much you want to bite the chubby cheeks right off his face. And then the next couple of weeks go by, and you settle into a zombie routine. Your boobs start to leak through your clothes, and you haven't bathed in a week. Also, your hair is literally the most terrible it's ever been. But whatever, you're getting through it. But by 6 weeks, the wheels start to fall off. You're thinking, why am I so exhausted? Why do I still look like I'm 5 months pregnant? Why am I still spending all my time nursing? And what punk invented cluster feeding because I will punch him right in his stupid face? At 6 weeks, I was a little, frustrated with how much I was doing to care for our baby. In other words, I didn't feel like Dave was being that helpful, and the responsibility of managing most of it by myself was overwhelming. I didn't mention any of this to him, though. I just bottled it up nice and tight and shoved it down deep where it could never bother anybody. Everyone knows that's the best way to handle your problems, right? Then one day we were chatting about something, and Chernobyl fell out of his mouth. I'm tired. That's what he said. Those were the words. My world shifted on its axis, and my eyes widened to 8 times their natural size. But he didn't notice. He was too busy talking. I'm just so exhausted from waking up early this morning. Blah, blah, blah. More ill-conceived words. You know that TV show Snapped? It's a docu-style series about real-life crimes where women just snap and take down someone on the way. That was me. I went full on Sybil. I was crying. I was laughing. I was trying to figure out who would raise this baby if I strangled Dave with the plastic tubing from my breast pump. To quote one of the most famous sayings in our entire marriage, I shout cried, on my wedding day, I never thought I could hate you as much as I hate you right now. It was not one of my best moments. But luckily for me, Dave, and all the other humans on this planet, relationships are full of opportunities for grace. Even when the baby started sleeping, and we started sleeping, I was a mess. I loved Jackson, but I didn't really feel bonded to him. I was so terrified of doing something wrong that I never let myself relax. I was so focused on housework and chores and making sure his onesie stayed spotless that I never just enjoyed my time as a new mom. I think because I was so worried about failing him, I ended up failing myself. Because I was so concerned with how we should all look as a family, I didn't take the time to let myself feel connected. I continued this pattern with my second son, Sawyer, so that when I became a mother of two, I had a serious case of postpartum depression. I spent almost every day imagining what it would be like to run away from home. I sat in our living room, breastfeeding my week-old baby, while a 20-month-old ran around the room littered with toys and dirty diapers I hadn't yet thrown away, and I'd think, I should just drive away and never look back. Everyone here would be better off without me. Because I didn't feel like I was succeeding at being a mom, the one thing I should innately know how to do, I was positive I was a failure. In retrospect, I can recognize that my perception of this role was based on images I saw online and in magazines, but at the time, I was too sleep-deprived to know I was chasing an impossibility. I had spent so much time worrying about not living up to some Pinterest-worthy standard that I completely lost who I actually was. Oh, those were dark days. When I look at pictures of that time, my hair might be combed and I might even be wearing some lipstick, but my eyes look haunted. So this chapter is for the new mamas or the soon-to-be mamas. Listen up. You don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to know everything. The mechanics of keeping a newborn alive are fairly simple. Feed it, cuddle it, love it, change it when it's wet, keep it warm, cuddle it again. A new mother's daily list of goals should boil down to 1, take care of the baby. 2, take care of yourself. Boom, the end. Darn it, you didn't get to the laundry today? Look at your list again. Did you take care of the baby? Yes? Did you take care of yourself? Also yes? Oh, I think you're crushing this new mom business then. I guess the laundry can wait. What's that? You're sad because you haven't lost the baby weight? Check out your handy-dandy to-do list with exactly 2 items on it. Is the baby still alive? Awesome. How about you? Are you still breathing in and out? Well then, it looks like you're the greatest mom ever. Keep on trucking. Pinterest is awesome, and decorating your nursery in perfectly coordinating colors is half the fun of conceiving a child. Looking at Instagram? Heck, I still look at all those pregnant Instagrammers for adorable, bump-appropriate wardrobe tips, and I'm not even pregnant. It makes sense to look outside yourselves when you're unsure about something new, and we are rarely as uncertain as we are during new motherhood. But let me tell you this, because I didn't understand it until years later. The God who made the moon and the stars and the mountains and the oceans, the Creator who did all of those things, believed that you and your baby were meant to be a pair. That doesn't mean you're going to be a perfect fit. That doesn't mean you won't make mistakes. It does mean that you need not fear failure, because you can't fail a job you were created to do. Somewhere, some cynical reader is thinking about all the parents who do fail. There are plenty of mamas who make bad choices, who hurt themselves or their children. As a former foster parent, I know firsthand that there are babies suffering right now from abuse and neglect, and even if a divine plan brought them to their mamas, it might not be the best answer for them to stay there. But I'm not speaking about those mamas. I'm talking to you. Don't be overwhelmed with anxiety that your baby should be on a sleep schedule, eating organic foods, or sitting up by now. I'm talking to the person who is reading all of the books and all of the articles and feels overwhelmed by what's right when there are so many possible wrongs. The very fact that you are so concerned, sweet friend, means you're engaged and focused and dedicated to doing what's best. That makes you the best kind of parent. The rest will take care of itself. Things that helped me. Number one, finding a tribe. Join a church group, go to Mommy and Me yoga, or look online for a club to join. Look for a group of women who understand what it means to be a new mom too. There's so much power in solidarity. There's so much grace when you're talking with someone who also has baby puke on her shirt. Number two, staying away from Pinterest. For the love of all that is holy, nobody should be allowed on Pinterest after a big life event. Why? Because you feel like you're missing out, or that your life, nursery, or post-baby body should look like what you're finding on the internet. Pay attention to what is giving you anxiety or making you question yourself. If it's social media, then do your heart a favor and take a break from it. I promise it will still be there when you're getting more sleep and feeling less emotional. Number three, getting out of the house. Every single day. The best thing you can do for yourself, your sanity, and your baby is to leave the scene of the crime. Leave the place with the dishes in the sink and the overflowing diaper genie. Put your baby in a carrier or a stroller and go on a walk around the neighborhood. Put on some headphones and listen to Beyonce or Adele or a podcast on business ethics. Do whatever you have to do to remind yourself that there is a life beyond your nest and that you are still part of it. Number four, talking to someone about my feelings. An effective way for us to overcome lies is to speak them aloud to a partner. Whether you choose your spouse, your friend, or a trusted family member, sharing with them that you're struggling can give you the support you need to see all of the falsities that are popping up in your life. Chapter 9. The Lie? I'm Not a Good Mom. If we're going to talk about how much I struggled as a new mom, then we also have to talk about how much I have struggled as a mom in general. Navigating what it means to be a mother while dealing with a newborn baby is brutal. But what comes next? That's an emotional mind screw of epic proportions. When my oldest was 7, he crushed my soul over Cheerios. "You know what you need, Mommy?" he asked me one morning while I was pouring cereal into a bowl shaped like a bulldog's face. When a child gives you an opener like that, the conversation could go in any direction imaginable. Maybe I needed a superhero cape, or a new spatula, or pink hair. His train of thought could go anywhere. "What?" I wanted to know. "What do I need?" "You need one of those necklaces with our initials on them. You know, the ones with the letters for each kid's name." At the time, monogram charm necklaces were all the rage. "Yes, I know those necklaces." "You should get one of those. All the moms at my school have them," he told me between bites. "You need to get one too." "Okay." I was a bit confused. "Why do I need to get one?" He smiled at me happily. "So you can finally be like all the other moms." Finally. Like all the other moms. A handful of words shouldn't crush you, shouldn't make you question yourself as a mother. But when you're already questioning yourself, and then someone, not just your son, but anyone, brings up the exact thing you've been worried about, it doesn't really take much to push you over the edge. I hadn't worried about what my jewelry, or lack thereof, said about me as a mom, but I was glaringly aware of how different I was from other mothers at Jackson's school events. I just didn't know that he'd noticed as well. I grappled with his statement for days. His suggestion to be like all the other moms meant that he recognized I wasn't like them already. It meant that he saw me as different, and when you're little, all you really want is to be just like everybody else. What he noticed is that I'm not like the other moms because I work a lot. I very rarely get to drop him off at school or pick him up. Because of that, I made a special effort to volunteer in his classroom every other week. But that wasn't right either. Because even though I sat in the teeny tiny chair cutting papers and stuffing homework folders like the other volunteers, I wasn't in jeans or yoga pants. I was in high heels and a white blazer that I should have known better than to wear on a day they were making teepees out of brown modeling clay. Another mom was sure to point that out to me. I was wearing that